Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Patricia Berry. I represent the appellants and Terry and Eddie Elwood, the parents, and Darla Elwood are present in court today. May it please the court. What I'd like to do is first talk about the case called Elwood v. Morin, the attorney fee appeal, 0455630. And what I depend on for a reversal that the case was not frivolous is the fact that I thought I had a conspiracy, or at least the most important element. As the judge found at, that's found at AER 7, the willful participants in the concerted action, probably the one of the three tests that the Ninth Circuit uses to determine whether or not a conspiracy existed. And for that reason, I do not see how that the conspiracy claim for which attorney's fees were ordered could have been frivolous. Again, I reemphasize that Judge Barrett found that the facts of the complaint sufficiently pled that the defendants were willful participants in concerted action to deprive Darla Elwood of her equal protection and due process rights under the 14th Amendment. Then the other cause of action, which was Civil Code Section 49A, in her initial decision, Judge Barrett said that there was a dearth of cases. And I argued that it was one of first impression. In addition, the facts were not adequately reflected or repeated in the decision. The taking of the child occurred secretly, without court order, without a warrant, and with no court petition pending. Then, and what I depend on most, is that in the Boyle appeal, number 0255, number 02, I can't think of the case number now, 5507, I think it is, the Ninth Circuit mediator, an attorney who I assume would be among the best of the highly qualified working for this prestigious Court of Appeals, nominated Mr. Boyle's case for inclusion in the mediation program, and I received permission by court order to argue this, or that this portion of my argument would go to this panel to determine whether or not the case was frivolous. And because it was nominated for inclusion, my position is that I have a reasonable, not just a reasonable attorney, but somebody with the authority of the Ninth Circuit willing to nominate the case for settlement. There is obviously, she thought that I had pled a sufficient claim against Mr. Boyle, which was identical. He was a part of this conspiracy that I allege in the fifth and sixth causes of action. And clearly, he or she believed that I would have the facts, given what I had already pled, which was a fact-intensive First Amendment complaint, that I had stated at least a good enough claim that she thought, or he thought, I forget if it was a man or a woman, thought that there was a chance of reversal such that he or she was willing to nominate it for inclusion in the mediation program. It failed. We went forward. And then finally, I want to say, at no time did any judge or anybody ever warn me that any of my claims were frivolous. I might acknowledge that the fourth cause of action, the court had said that I had pled sufficient facts against Mr. Morin and Mr. Delaplane, the two fathers, such that they could be, I could pursue a claim for making false claims of child abuse against my client, Darla Elwood. Those claims of false child abuse form the factual basis in large part for the conspiracy claim. So when it was pled under a state claim, she found sufficient facts for it to go forward and, of course, refused to award attorney's fees. Now I'd like to talk a minute about 0455635. Again, I have the Ninth Circuit, as far as I'm concerned, backing me up. We have the law of the case doctrine, and not one appellee ever addressed the fact that three distinguished jurists, your colleagues, Judges Levy, Rawlinson, and Hawkins, on July 28th, 03, determined that my briefs in the 0256917 case, which was the appeal of the 024656 case, from which attorney's fees were awarded, and now make
the appeal of the order dismissing the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That affirmed the order dismissing the case.
No, what I'm talking about now was Judge Rawlinson, Judge Levy, and Judge Hawkins denied the three appellees' motions for summary affirmance. They were claiming there's no merit, don't let her go to a full panel, this doesn't deserve the full consideration by the Ninth Circuit.
Our threshold for that is awfully low.
Oh, it's awfully low.
It would be very odd for us in a civil case to summarily affirm if it just weren't plain on the face of the pleadings.
Well,
so I'm not sure you can draw much significance from that order.
Well, at least the the three jurists did say, Judge.
It's a motions panel, and
right.
And sure, I mean they denied the motion for summary affirmance,
but they also noted that my appeal briefs had merit, Your Honor, and I think that's important in view of the facts on remand. Then it was found to be frivolous. But they did take a close look and found that they weren't going to grant those motions for summary affirmance, and they were arguing, in effect, frivolousness and so on. And those three judges said, nope, there's merit to these, to all of the issues raised in that particular appeal, which was the 024656 case involving the five jurists, Mr. Drescher and Ms. Hutchinson. The other thing that I depend on is that there, since Kay versus Erler was decided, the U.S. Supreme Court case on awarding attorney's fees to improper litigants, there has never been a case since Kay versus Erler was decided that an improper litigant, whether an attorney or non-attorney, whether plaintiff or defendant, in all of the cases in which an award of there's a fee-shifting statute, and I have supplied all of those cases, and I found one last night looking for it. But in any event, there are no cases that I'm aware of that an improper a litigant, whether attorney or non-attorney, was able to get attorney's fees.
What do we do? How do we deal with Ellis? I know it was pre-K, but how do we deal with it? It's a binding circuit precedent.
Well, that's a 1980 case, and I couldn't find any subsequent Ninth Circuit discussion of awarding fees to an improper prevailing defendant in a 1988 situation. However, I cited that Eastern District of Pennsylvania case, DiPaolo versus Moran, I have it in my brief, Your Honor. And in that case, they said that they felt, I cited at page 54 of my brief, in DiPaolo, DiPaolo versus Moran, they said that they felt that the validity of Ellis was in doubt because there was no discussion of the agency relationship, that is, of an attorney-client relationship having been created. And that was not discussed in Ellis versus Cassidy, and that's primarily on what the Supreme Court relied in order to hold that the successful improper attorney litigant in the Title VII case in the Kay versus Erler case was not entitled to attorney's fees. And in DiPaolo versus Moran, he declined to sanction the prevailing pro se attorney relying on an 11th Circuit case, which I also cite in the brief, Massengill versus Ray. And because the Ninth Circuit never revisited this issue, I would submit that Kay versus Erler would be the definitive case on which to determine whether Ellis versus Cassidy is good precedent or not at this time. Ellis versus Cassidy was decided in 1980.
Right. The difference between the two cases, and obviously a three-judge panel normally can't overrule precedent, but can if there's an intervening Supreme Court decision. The question is whether Kay is controlling or not. The difference, it seems to me, in Kay, and one that we'll have to explore, is this. Kay talked about the statutory history of this particular rule and applied it to pro per plaintiffs. I'm not sure the same rationale applies to pro per defendants who are attorneys because there are different incentives. That may or may not make any difference, and other circuits seem to support your view of this. But That's just something we have to look at in reevaluating Ellis.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that
he doesn't deal with this directly.
I submit that my lawsuit brought against Mr. Drescher was not frivolous. And, in fact, when he sought attorney's fees initially in his motion to dismiss, it was denied by Judge Baird. And, furthermore,
for failure to consult, right?
No. That was another situation. He sought attorney's
fees. That's right. I recall it now.
Yeah. Okay. And then the other issue was when he finally did file a motion for attorney's fees, he, like Ms. Barrientos, did not do the local rule.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I can tell you, Your Honor, I didn't cite it in my brief, but I did find SEC versus Waterhouse, 41 Fed 3rd, 805, Second Circuit, 1994. And it determined under Kay versus Erler that the prevailing defendant, he was an improper attorney defendant seeking attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And the court found all of the factors present to make an award of fees, but said they could not because of Kay versus Erler. They found there was no substantial justification for the court's position, and it squares on all fours with our case, except my position is that my case was never frivolous in the first place for the reasons I've argued in my brief and here. But I think this is very important because it was the only one I found that came so close to our situation, improper attorney litigant, prevailed in, I don't know, I guess that would be it's definitely a fee-shifting statute. It's a civil rights statute, Equal Access to the Justice Act. And they did award him expenses, but they said, no, their hands were tied by Kay versus Erler. So Mr. Kaufman described in numerous cases as an attorney, improper defendant, litigant, could not get attorney's fees. Now, I'd like to talk a minute. Did anybody have any questions? I was
no,
going to move now.
Yes.
Okay. I have 8 minutes. All right. I want to talk really fast about my denial of attorney's fees in the 055727 case that was combined with the 055724 case. Now, there was a pattern of harassment in terms of the enforcement of judgment. They started out with the debtor's exam. Didn't ask her any questions. Didn't demand documents that would establish the more Marsden community interests, which was minuscule in any event. But they didn't even ask for those documents. Then I came along and submitted what I thought was a great brief in September in the 0455630. And then in October, they're filing their notice of levy, and they're filing their that third-party garnishment. And that third-party garnishment, I'll get into that in just a minute, is a nightmare. You could not figure it out. In fact, I'll give you a guidance. If you take down, if I try to explain to you verbally, you're going to go, Miss Berry, you're driving us nuts. Well, they drove me nuts. And I think it was totally related because they knew I was doing all this pro bono work for Miss Elwood, and there were all kinds of things happening, which I supplemented and put into the AER, and they want stricken. But it shows the relationship between what they were doing in the enforcement action and what I was doing in other cases. The two attorney fee appeals in this case, the Moran child custody litigation, the Della Plain child custody litigation, all of that was going on. And each time I took a step in that case, they were coming up against me in this enforcement of litigation. Yes,
I don't understand.
Judge,
you sought sanctions under 1927, is that
1927.
Right? Well, how does 1927 apply to their efforts to enforce their judgment?
Well, because, first of all, nothing ever came of them, number one. Number two,
That's really not an answer, is it?
Well, I think it is an answer when you look at the method that they employ. In other words, what I'm saying, and I think 1927 says, it's like an abusive process. They had a right to enforce a judgment, but they did it for a malicious motive because they knew that my client, and in fact, Mr. Cook described my client as an insolvent. He admitted that she didn't have any assets and still pursued these worthless enforcements. Now, when you do the notice of levy, for example, like Judge Barrett said, well, Ms. Berry, so what if the notice of levy was not in James Delaplane's home? And then she cited the statute that says if the notice of levy is not in the judgment debtor's name, that's not going to cause the enforcement action to fail. But guess what? The third party was the homeowner. This is the fellow who owned the home. And this was not a fraudulent conveyance, as the folks on the other side will try to persuade you. It was a home that Mr. Delaplane had purchased as a single man prior to getting married, something like maybe a year or half year before they married. And her name never went on the deed. So what he was trying to do was say, oh, well, we're going to prove up her community interest without having done the discovery to establish the Moore Marsden interest. Now, it's a simple arithmetical computation, but it's gotten very complicated. They'd have to figure out what this, what he bought it for, what was the pay down of the principal, what was owed at the time of the first refi, and then what was owed at the second refi, and so on. Those would have been all the kind of information that he should have been seeking if he was serious about doing this. The other issue I want to enforce or bring up is the fact that I kept saying, look, the marshal's office doesn't do the notice. Your own levying officer has to do it, and therefore it's left up to the attorney to act with immediately within 20 days. And my position is the levy should have been quashed, not only because it wasn't in the homeowner's name, but because he waited for 4 or 5 months to try and sell the home.
Well, it all sounds very, very complicated, and you have to ask the question, where did Judge Baird abuse her discretion in denying the
motion to quash? Because the
no attorney's fees.
Oh, on the attorney's fees?
Sanctions, yes.
On the sanctions?
Where did she abuse her discretion?
Because of I detailed at in the AER, I detailed all of the extra work I had to do because of the way they pursued it. For example, in the writ of garnishment, there is no writ of garnishment. And I'd like to, if I could quickly, Judge Schwarzer, to answer your question, demonstrate to you how confusing it is by referring to the supplemental the supplemental documents that were provided by the opposing counsel in conjunction with mine. Now, there was an affidavit for a writ of execution for Mr. Drescher. That's the 024656 case. They never did the 024656 case. They put it in this 024655 case. So I'm going, what are they talking about? I couldn't figure out what was going on. So he gets a writ of execution in the 024655 case, and I'm going, what's going on here? But it was for Mr. Drescher. The instructions that they put into evidence for you to look at to the U.S. Marshal was in the Morin case. The proofs of service that they supplied are in the Morin case, which is the 018582 case. My position is if you're going to do a writ of garnishment in the 024656 case, you have to have proofs of service. You have to have instructions to the marshal that it's Elwood versus Drescher 024656. If you go to my AER 113-30, and then you try to compare that to the supplemental appellee's ER at 7 through, I think, 19, you're going to be as confused as I am. I can't even tell if there is a legitimate garnishment.
Well, given all of that confusion, can you say that it was an abuse of discretion for her to conclude that there was no malice? Because malice is required for 1927.
I would say there is malice because I argued at the trial court below and in my briefs here that they were tracking what they were double-teaming me. They figured, okay, we'll distract her. I was late getting the brief in to the 045635 case. I didn't get it filed till December. The trial in Morin versus Elwood, which was a PF 1184 case in state court, was moving along at the same time that they did the notice of levy. Remember, they're trying to take her husband's house away from her. We were just freaking. At the same time, I'm supposed to be getting ready for a custody trial with Mr. Morin. And then he waits 5 months to try and sell the house, and Judge Carney, within a month, says, no, you're out the door. Then when I filed the racial violence complaint against Morin in state court on May 2nd, 2005, get him served in July of 2005, they're hitting Darla with a motion for some kind of rollover. I mean, it was – I've never heard of that in an enforcement action. Judge Carney was puzzled by it, and he didn't even demand that I file an opposition and threw it out of court. Not happy with that, then they started an SPDT, subpoena ducis tecum, to get information on a car. So I had to put in an objection. Then it seeped over to the Morin litigation that was represented by another attorney, Mr. Kotler. The malice was definitely there. Mr. Morin, in our pleadings, and this has never been controverted, said, I'm going to get even with you for getting involved with and marrying this guy that you married. And here was the guy that he's trying to take the house away from while we're trying to fight on the custody issue in state court. So then here I am trying to juggle all of this together. Nothing ever comes of this because they were on notice from her debtor's exam. She had no assets. I would say, Judge Schwarzer, that is malicious, abusive process. Do they have a right to enforce the judgment? Yes. But do they have a duty to conduct proper discovery so they could at least determine the Moore Marsden? Because upon analysis, there is not sufficient Moore Marsden for a real bid to go through that could satisfy Mr. Morin's $14,500 in attorney's fees. So while they're hitting me with this enforcement of judgment, and by the way, it took me hours to research. I have that set out in the AER in the motion to quash. I set out all the extra work we had to do. Ms. Kim was completely, as I put in my declaration, was completely like, what is going on here? And we had no idea where the service was of Mr. Delaplane on the third-party garnishment.
Your time has expired.
All right. Thank you. Let me just gather all this up.
Thank you, counsel. Do we have a time allocation from the other side?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. Thank you. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for myself. My name is Robert Drescher. I represent Warren and myself. 5 minutes for the Deputy Attorney General to address her issues in regards to the state jurists. 3 minutes for Ms. Brenner, who represents the county and the county employees. And then 2 minutes for Mr. Perkis, who will address the issue as to the enforcement of the judgment.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Drescher. I am here in both two capacities, one as an attorney representing a client, one as a pro per defendant. Before I get into the bulk of my argument, let me address something that this panel just brought up, and that is the case of Kay. And it's a very important distinction that this Court needs to address. The difference between Ellis and the difference between K.
I think I understand the difference, but K seems to cut a pretty wide swath, and other circuits have agreed with your opponent that K ought to be applied equally to defendants and plaintiffs. Tell us why we should go against the tide.
Certainly, Your Honor, and if this Court would review the May 25th, 2004 order from the District Court went to great lengths specifically to distinguish K. And if I can basically do it in a nutshell, what K addressed was a case that had merit. This case had no merit. And K basically said that the same policy considerations do not exist when the pro per attorney litigant is a prevailing defendant rather than a prevailing plaintiff. Ensuring that a defendant attorney obtained counsel does not help to filter meritless claims, nor ensure vigorous prosecution of meritorious ones. And if the Court would remember that one of the holdings of Kay was that the statutory policy was to kind of force everybody to hire an attorney. And what the District Court did on May 25, 2004, in awarding the attorney fees to the pro per defendant myself, it kind of said that may be, but in a case where there has no merit, it has no purpose. And in fact, the Court goes on to say, in contrast, awarding attorney fees to prevailing defendants protects them from burdensome litigation with no legal or factual basis, exactly as this Court held in its initial affirmation of the appeal of the judgment, and we are now faced with that issue again. This Court found in 2004 initially that the claims of the plaintiffs had no merit, had no factual findings, and in fact were vexatious. The District Court, in awarding its attorney fees, made it clear that the claims lacked factual support, were vexatious, were brought only for the sole purpose of annoying and harassing and vexing Mr. Marin. And the Court made it clear in its award of its attorney fees on the March 25, 2004 order that K did not apply because, again, we're dealing with a meritless claim, not a claim that had merit. And the whole purpose behind K and Ellis was to prevent frivolous claims moving forward. Now, I, as a pro per defendant and attorney, did have to exhaust a substantial amount of hours from my busy practice. And as the Court held in 1980 in Ellis, it said that the award of attorney fees furthers the underlying policy of discouraging frivolous or harassing litigation, exactly what we have here in front of this Court, that the appellees have actually suffered pecuniary loss since they have been required to take time away from their practices to prepare and defend the lawsuit. Again, identical to this case. That legal service have actually been performed. The appellees did not seek out a chance for pro se litigation to compensate for an inactive practice. They were forced to defend against frivolous claims by a plaintiff who was apparently bent on endless litigation. Again, identical to this case. If this Court reviews the records, we have had 5 constant years of litigation. The appellee, Mr. Marin, has had to endure case after case after case being brought forth by Ms. Elwood through the services of Ms. Berry. This is the second time that we have appeared in front of this panel. We have also been in front of the Second District Court of Appeals in the state case. Ms. Berry also did a writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, not to mention the countless state court actions and federal court actions being brought by Ms. Berry. Each and every one of them has ended the exact same way in favor of Mr. Marin. And again, we are here again, Your Honors, for another frivolous matter. My client has had to endure 5 years of this, and we ask for attorney fees on this appeal, as well as upholding the attorney fees awarded in the district court. This is not a case of first impression. This is not a case of domestic violence. This is a case of a vindictive, vexatious litigant who is bent on harassing Mr. Marin and continues to do so year after year. In the end result, Your Honor, there is no abuse of discretion in this case. In order for this Court to find abuse of discretion, they would have to find that the district court either misapplied facts or made a gross error at law. There is none. This was pure discretionary. The trial court, sitting in judgment over the thousands of pages of documents presented in front of it, found that the claims brought forth by the plaintiff in all the cases had no legal foundation, had no merit, had no facts to support it, were vexatious and harassing, and brought forth for the sole purpose of harassing, annoying, and vexing Mr. Marin. And for that reason, the district court ordered attorney fees to be paid. This court rarely issues attorney fee awards in civil rights cases because of the fact that there's an overriding policy not to do so, because it could quell or quash a person's right to address the government, to address wrongdoings. However, a review of this record will show that time after time what has been occurring is that the plaintiffs have been attempting to relitigate child custody matters in federal court. They have brought judges, commissioners, and members of the county forward in a federal lawsuit because they have the audacity to rule against them. If this court reviews the record, they will see that every single jurist, every single member of the county, and even myself, have successfully represented or ruled against the plaintiffs in every matter brought forth in every forum. What has occurred is the plaintiffs are attempting to use this court as a sword, not a shield.
Do you concede that Ms. Elwood is insolvent and unable to pay the pay the fees at this point?
No, Your Honor, we do not concede that for the following reasons. We believe, and will be proven at trial, that there was a fraudulent conveyance of the house that she lives in. If the record would show,
so you take the residence asset or any other assets?
She's also driving around in a brand-new $70,000 Lexus, and her husband drives around in a $65,000 car. If somebody is as insolvent as she claims, she certainly lives high enough on the totem pole.
I know, really, I realize this is outside the record, but I addressed you. You say you don't concede insolvency.
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that she would be found to be insolvent at all. And that's one of the problems that they've been fighting so vigorously. And Mr. Perkis will address that specific issue as to the enforcement. I have not had much to do with that except
right.
Read the pleadings. And I do know as a fact as to some of the facts of the of information outside the record. But in my opinion, there's not a competent jurisdiction that would find her to be insolvent. She hasn't even filed bankruptcy, which would have been, if she truly is insolvent, she should have used the power of the court to declare bankruptcy, which she has not done. So that in itself is an outward manifestation that she would not be able to prove insolvency.
You have a little over 2 minutes left.
Okay, well, Your Honor, I would like to save that for my esteemed colleagues if they would need to, unless there's any questions of the panel. In conclusion, just basically that this is not a frivolous. These matters were completely frivolous. They were brought for an ill purpose. No factual basis. The district court found them to be frivolous, vexatious, and brought forth to annoy Mr. Marin. They properly awarded attorney fees. There's no abuse of discretion in this matter, and request that this court uphold and affirm the attorney fee awards and also award attorney fees and costs for bringing forth this appeal. Thank you very much.
Very good. We'll hear from the Attorney General.
Good morning. I am Sandra Barrientos, Deputy Attorney General from the California Department of Justice. I am here representing Commissioner Robert Saccone, Judge John Farrell, Judge Hay Kahihian, Judge William McLaughlin, Referee Valerie Skiba, and the California Department of Justice. In the underlying case, the plaintiffs in that case brought the case against the jurist because they just simply didn't like the trial court's rulings. And throughout the litigation, which was only a motion to dismiss, the plaintiffs accused the jurist of hanging their hat on the trilogy of cases, Rooker-Feldman and Younger abstention. They never conceded that those were hurdles that they had to surpass before proceeding with their lawsuit. They just chose to ignore the law. They never argued or presented any facts or law as to why those doctrines didn't apply.
Let's take Rooker-Feldman. If your conclusion is correct that these claims are barred by Rooker-Feldman, you're not entitled to fees, are you?
Your Honor, I am, because they were brought under 1983. The entire lawsuit was brought under 1983.
I understand that. But if the claims are barred by Rooker-Feldman, Rooker-Feldman is jurisdictional, how can you recover fees on a jurisdictional argument?
Well, Your Honor, because we were required to defend him, and the case was brought under 1983 for civil rights, and the law, 1988, says that if you prevail in a lawsuit for 1983, you may be entitled to attorney's fees. Now, not all the claims were barred by...
Do you have a case that ever awarded fees that were on a case that was dismissed on the grounds of Rooker-Feldman?
I believe Franceschi versus Schwartz. I don't recall exactly if that's the case, Your Honor, but that involved judicial immunity, which wouldn't be a jurisdictional issue.
That is not jurisdictional.
Yeah. That would be correct. Now, if that's the question, and I'm afraid I don't have a legal authority to support my position, it is that it was brought under 1983.
Well, that doesn't really answer the question.
That is correct.
If there is no jurisdiction, then you wouldn't be considered a prevailing party. So, therefore, you wouldn't qualify under 1988.
My next point was going to be not all the jurists were absolved from this based on Rooker-Feldman. There was Younger abstention also on some of these cases.
But isn't that a jurisdictional defense as well?
Younger abstention, I believe, is not. The Rooker-Feldman is a jurisdiction. I think Younger abstention is considered a we may have this, but we're not going to abstain because it's an ongoing state proceeding. Now, the plaintiffs in the underlying case never objected to the attorney fees based on the Rooker-Feldman being a jurisdictional issue, so I'm afraid that I am not prepared to address that, and I do apologize to the court for that.
It's a problem, I think, with the Rooker-Feldman argument. With Younger abstention, I'm not sure it's jurisdictional, but on the other hand, it's not ruling on the merits either. I mean, you're not saying it's frivolous. You're saying, no, we have ongoing state proceedings. So conceptually, it's like Rooker-Feldman, because really it's not a determination of who the prevailing party is, right?
Well, Your Honor, the problem I have with the whole analysis where we're heading is that under in that scenario, then anyone would be entitled to bring a 1983 lawsuit against a jurist without knowing that this cannot happen, just in order to either try to stay the state court cases or, in other way, try to vex the state court jurist. And in that matter, just saying it's a 1983 and it's jurisdiction, so you don't get to prevail because you don't the federal court doesn't have jurisdiction over this matter.
It means you don't get fees. It doesn't mean that you don't win, which you did.
But we did win.
Yeah, no.
We did win. And they never addressed why. I mean, this is the problem. She kept saying, we have a prima facie case. If you have a prima facie case, then it assumes that you said enough things to overcome those hurdles, to set up enough facts or why the law should be changed to become over those procedure hurdles. But that was never the case here. And then in bringing this appeal, they argue that they are entitled to attorney's fees, and because the district court abused her discretion in allowing me to refile that motion for attorney's fees. But they didn't raise that in the lower court. They raised it for the first time on appeal. They also, for the first time on appeal, say she spent too much time on this case. They never raised that with the court.
Did they raise in opposition to the attorney's fees application?
That the case was not meritless. That they had established a prima facie case that they were entitled to proceed against the state court jurist and the California Department of Justice. In fact, as to the California Department of Justice, initially they said, yes, we can bring this lawsuit because all we're seeking is prospective injunctive relief. And then later, in a notice of erratum of legal argument, they say, oops, no, you're right, we can't bring that. But we could substitute the head of the Department of Justice to seek the relief we want, but we don't know how to do that. And that was just a constant thing of what we had to deal with in this case. And it's been 4 years since we've been here on the same things. And it's just, we understand that in order to award 1988 fees, it is a high hurdle for the defendant to jump to get those established. And the district court made very specific findings as to why she was awarding these fees. And I don't believe Judge Baer took this lightly at all.
Okay, you're down to your last 20 seconds. Anything else you want to say to someone?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. We'll hear from the county.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Anita Susan Brenner. I'm with Law Offices of Torres and Brenner here in Pasadena, and we are outside counsel for the County of Los Angeles and its employees. In this case, we represent on Elwood v. Moran, the County of Los Angeles and two social workers sued in their public capacities, Ann Wellman and Barbara Dallas. And in Elwood versus Drescher, we represent a young attorney named Judy Hutchinson, who is a county employee but was sued in her individual capacity and for punitive damages. Obviously, we have been up to another panel of this court, and the motions to dismiss in both cases were affirmed on appeal. I would submit that the district court did not abuse its discretion in awarding attorney's fees. In particular, my clients are basically peripheral to the sets of issues briefed in these hundreds of paragraphs of complaints and hundreds of pages in the record before the court.
Well, refresh my recollection. On what basis were these defendants dismissed?
These defendants were dismissed with respect to Wellman, Dallas, and the county on the Elwood v. Marin case, because there was no factual basis, there were insufficient facts alleged to prove up the theory of conspiracy as alleged, and the district court rejected my argument with respect to the statute of limitations.
Right, but in other words, as I recall, the county defendants, you didn't have the same Rooker-Feldman or Younger abstention dismissals. These
no.
are the merits one way or the other. Yeah.
That's correct. Basically, there were numerous opportunities to amend, and there's a lengthy reporter's transcript of the oral argument before the district court where the district court asked counsel for the plaintiffs to go paragraph by paragraph, tell me which paragraphs allege anything about the county social workers. She listed four or five, and they went paragraph by paragraph, and none of them sufficed. With respect to Judy Hutchinson in the second case, Elwood v. Drescher, which arose in the middle of Elwood v. Marin, suddenly we were all served with this new complaint, which surprisingly named as a defendant one of the counsel in Elwood v. Moran. In that case, Judy Hutchinson was, the sole allegations against her were that she failed to return phone calls and that on a particular day, some state judges, two of them, walked through a door and she was beckoned and followed them into the door. And it was, Judge Baird found, and I would submit correctly so, that this was insufficient to establish a civil rights violation based on a theory of conspiracy under Woodrum. And in particular, at that hearing and in the hearings with respect to attorney's fees, we did point out that Ms. Berry is intimately familiar with the facts of Woodrum and the requirements of Woodrum because she was counsel for parties in that case. So it was clear in this case that...
Time has expired, too, but you should wrap up quickly.
Two things. Counsel mentioned 49A, the state actions. Judge Baird did not award attorney's fees on the 49A, so it's irrelevant. Secondly, my case was never, she states, my case was never frivolous in the first place, yet Judge Baird and the Ninth Circuit found that these claims against my clients were groundless. And finally, my client was not part of any efforts to enforce judgments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Here for Mr. Perkis. You're going to talk to us about enforcement in 2 minutes. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. My name is Bob Perkis, and I represent Joseph Moran and Robert Drescher in case numbers 0555724 and 0555727. And this deals with, excuse me, the motion in which the defendant, or I should say plaintiff Elwood, in fact asked for attorney fees against us. In this particular case, that was denied. The basis of her denial, or I'm sorry, the basis of her motion, her appeal here is an abuse of discretion. However, if you take a look at what happened in the underlying case, you see there was no abuse of discretion. There was no unnecessary work that we caused on the plaintiff. Because if you take a look at exactly what we did just very minimal execution or enforcement in this case. We did two OEXs, both of them done at the same day, one in each case. So we obviously minimized the amount of effort and time. And then we did two levies. And that was it. What happened after that, all is a result of what Ms. Elwood did in reacting to that. And what she did was, in fact, she made a...
She resisted.
I'm sorry?
She resisted.
She resisted. But unfortunately, her resistance caused us to have to respond. Her first resistance was a claim of exemption. The problem is when you make a claim of exemption, a couple things happen. One is you assume, from our side, that you only make a claim of exemption if, in fact, there are assets that were actually levied on. If there are no assets there, there's no basis for a claim of exemption. So we, in fact, filed an opposition to the claim of exemption. If we hadn't done that, we would have lost any lien that was that resulted from the levy. So our response was in response to her claim of exemption. What it turned out to be, as we pointed out in our opposition, is that her claim was in fact premature. The court agreed. Ms. Berry, at the hearing on February 22nd of 2005, agreed with that in fact the claim was premature. and, in fact, that she just couldn't let go of it. And that was really the problem. In other words, the cause of these motions was a result of her filing.
Okay, let me take your point. You're over time unless
I'm sorry.
The panel has any questions. I think we have your argument in hand. So thank you. Thank
okay,
you for
I'm
your
sorry.
Argument. And the case just heard will be submitted. You used up all of your time on in your opening. So we thank all of you for your presentations and your arguments.
I just need to let the panel. I've done some heavy thinking on this, and I'm the one who advised my clients to go forward. And I thought I had done terrific briefing, and I stand by my briefing. And I don't think that anything I did was frivolous, but I can't. If you want to punish somebody, I want it to be me. I can't do this to my clients.
Thank you, counsel. We understand your argument.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case just heard will be submitted, and we will be in recess.
Thank you.
All right. This court for this session is Thank you.